Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part two of a fine audio collage on state terrorism and corporate terrorism. Al-Qaeda and ISIS are a bunch of amateurs compared to these guys. I hope you'll stay tuned. We continue with part two of the audio collage, The Terror Threat. The voices are taken from the 19-year history of the little-known, radical, and excellent radio show, Unwelcome Guests. Every installment is archived at unwelcomeguests.net. The backbone of the collage is a brilliant speech given by Canadian scholar John McMurtry in 2001, just after the U.S. started its ongoing war against Afghanistan. The collage splices in brief other talks that illustrate or complement or give specific examples of the main points McMurtry is making. The result is brilliant. Today's installment begins with torture. It goes on to consider macho sports, media bias and propaganda, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and the control of the world's oil. Here goes.
At the end of an empire, torture appears as a very important method for keeping the power of the imperial nation in place. And the message that I'd like to convey is that torture was part and parcel of a military ideological structure.
518.
The ACLU in 2005 had been pushing the U.S. military, the Pentagon, to release autopsy reports of civilians who died in Iraq during the first 2 years of the war. And they had to threaten court. I mean, they had the right under the Freedom of Information Act, but the Pentagon was really dragging their feet. Finally, they got copies of 44 autopsy reports. Now, these autopsy reports were the U.S. military doctors' examinations of the bodies after somebody died while in U.S. custody, civilians. So in October of 2005, they released a press release, and they said, well, of the 44 autopsy reports, 23 of those listed the cause of death as homicide. And these were multiple sites. And this wasn't just Abu Ghraib. I mean, this was multiple sites in Afghanistan and Iraq. The conditions of the body clearly indicated, and doctors had verified that these people were tortured to death. Extensive bruises, contortions, broken bones, strangulation, just really awful stuff. The rest of the bodies, the rest of the autopsy reports, the primary cause of death was heart failure while being tortured. And, you know, these were young people. So this was really, for the first time, absolute proof that we were torturing people to death on a wide scale, not just embarrassing them or having dogs snip at them and that, but really beating and killing people. And ACLU, with their press release, put this out, and AP picked it up. Associated Press, which reaches a billion people in the world, they put this out on their wire service to all 1,700 daily newspapers in the United States, to all 5,000 radio and television news programs across the country. And LexisNexis checks and further examination, we found out that 99.5% of them did not run the story. So LA Times had it on page A4. Seattle paper had it buried inside a larger story in Iraq, and the rest were small Midwest papers that actually covered it. So that meant that 1,600-plus newspaper editors saw that story and decided not to run it. And we don't know why, but they just decided that maybe they thought it would be unseen as unpatriotic, the American people wouldn't believe it, that we were torturing people to death. Whatever the reason, we know that this was a factual decision. So this wasn't just the high levels of MSNBC or Fox or that making a decision. This was right down inside of grassroots media in the U.S. today. And that really kind of set us back a bit. And we started to think about what that means and the degree to which an American empire will go to propagate and push and continue to push global capital power worldwide.
It was used as the method of interrogation. And this was part and parcel of a military doctrine and an ideology. One of the designers of this doctrine the Trinquier called torture the antidote to terrorism, and he called it a war weapon. So, because what's happening today in the U.S. is that we're not quite sure of what's going on. It is the same thing is happening. Torture is part and parcel of what goes on in Iraq, in Guantanamo Bay, in Afghanistan. Actually, there is a historian at the University of Wisconsin, Alfred McCoy, you know, wrote a book called The Question of Torture, and it's a very serious book because it took him many years to show what's going on, the kinds of tortures that are being implemented in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere are really a continuation of the experiments with torture which the CIA had engaged in between 1952 and 1962. In secret, the CIA was spending $1 billion a year between 1952 and 1962.
That is, in fact, their function. It is of demonstration, destructions, and killings to command by terror and seize whatever is wanted, with complicit governments like Canada's and Britain's barking and crouching behind, the real deal is struck beneath public notice. Incalculably more innocent people in terror in exchange for incalculably more oil supplies for U.S.-led corporations and, as a side deal, $200 billion in further giveaways of public revenues to corporations and the very rich in the U.S., another unseen aspect. But the primeval criminal gang structure is not tracked for two reasons. The first is that saturating conditioning disconnects people from reality. It is easy. Just tell the people someone is attacking them and then denounce anyone who protests as unpatriotic and a threat to the nation's security. These are Hermann Göring's words, and they transmit the code of this gang form of rule. Concealed under the most ludicrous lies, its coercion reigns supreme. Already university employees and indeed a talk show host have been unconstitutionally suspended in the U.S. for pointing out the most undeniable truths. The disorder goes to the heart of the ruling corporate psyche. Consider the pattern. Now moving into images of manliness and how the surrounding culture transmits this pattern.
507.
The sports culture has grown increasingly aggressive and violent, and we see that in the hockey fights and baseball fights. We'd be naive to think that the way grown men act, on the field or off, has no impact on how boys learn to think of themselves as men. But it's important to remember that what's being taught in a lot of modern sports is not just violence and aggression, but the even more powerful idea that being a real man is connected with being intimidating and controlling. Just look at what happens when a basketball player does an in-your-face dunk over his opponent and then rubs it in. The lesson about manhood is clear. You gain respect by disrespecting another person. Look at the phenomenal growth and popularity of pro wrestling. People can argue back and forth about whether it's sports or just pure theatrics, but one point that's hard to argue with is that what takes place both within the ring and outside of it is a celebration of dominance and the projection of power in a way that links being a man with being abusive and violent.
And it's telling the Undertaker that you better come get your man here. A great opportunity for the Undertaker to come down.
So boys are being taught over and over again that real manhood is connected to size and strength and muscularity.
The adolescent group mind plots in secret, and I'm thinking of working right up to the war room. The adolescent group mind plots in secret behind the closed doors of secluded forts for control of the rest of society to maximize the gang's private take. I really think we're at an adolescent gang stage of history. Sex and violence are the ruling images of its kingdom of ever bigger deals and attacks on a designated outgroups. The gang's ethos of power and control pervades the larger society with a barbaric code of acquisitive stratagem, takeover of others' territories, continuous extraction of gang tribute, and indiscriminate violence and armed force at will. The gang's ethos of power and control pervades the larger society with a barbaric code of acquisitive stratagem, takeover of others' territories, continuous extraction of gang tribute, and indiscriminate violence and armed force at will. Throughout group slogans and tough talk to reinforce the bonds of male and servant female bravado in the face of ever greater extremes of life deprivation, confiscation, and fear. The universal insecurity the many feel is, as the resistance grows, played back to them as what the gang is protecting them from. The logic of rule by force is then openly declared to protect them from the terror. The U.S. president declares an ultimatum to the world. You are either with us or for the terrorists. And after starving Afghanistan is carpet bombed, his administration proclaims, who will be next? Charles Krauthammer, glorious name, declares the mood in Time magazine, quote, America is no mere international citizen. It is a dominant power in the world, more dominant than any since Rome. Accordingly, America is in a position to reshape norms. How? By unapologetic and implacable demonstrations of will. This is as the bombs fall. The extortion racket of the neighborhood is, in a word, writ large as the international war against terrorism, a war in which those who monopolize terror are licensed to exempt themselves from its meaning.
705.
It's extremely Orwellian. I mean, I've never seen anything quite so peculiar as an anti-terror march where you've got the biggest terrorists on the planet leading it.
706. The definition of terrorism I found a dozen or so years ago, looked up, and it occurred quite specifically, it's acts of violence to pursue ideological political ends when they're committed by non-state actors, neatly avoiding the discussion about state terrorism, because according to that definition, it doesn't exist. I looked that up, by the way, when some Muslims in the East End of London had been arrested and charged with trying to make bombs. They hadn't actually made or let off any bombs. Nevertheless, the BBC chose to intersperse that footage with a video of some bombs going off in Madrid. So we had real people suffering real bomb attacks shown on the television as part of a report about some people being taken into custody, being charged with making bombs. Now that prompted me to see, what is the BBC actually doing here? Could that in itself be called an act of terrorism? And no, because it's by the state apparatus, that could perhaps be called terrorization, but terrorism was excluded. So this week, the focus on the use of terror to keep people afraid, not by independent organizations or even false flag covertly funded opposition groups, but by paid up nation states. So the US, as I see it, could easily be accused of terrorizing Pakistanis because it has drones over Pakistan ready to rain down death at a moment's notice. Now, quite apart from the terror of those who are the victims of murderous attacks, just the knowledge that the drones are there must exert a terrorizing effect on entire populations. Is it a stretch of the imagination to think that research is being carried out, even now, into the effects of terrorizing people with a view to using drones worldwide? 376.
So also going along these lines is the expanded use of the word terrorism in American media, or the threats of terrorism in that. But also this includes domestic terrorism and passing of laws that use terrorism as part of the justification for the law. Now, how many have ever heard of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act? Last year, I mean, this should have been in all the papers. I mean, this is November 27, 2006. Broadens punishments under the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, and they call any animal enterprise is any U.S. business that uses or sells animal products. Now, I think you'll be hard-pressed to think of those that don't, whether it's milk or wool or whatever. I mean, that covers most businesses in the country. And it says any interference with the business, including their loss of their profits, is a terrorist act. And any interference with any person or entity having any connection or relationship or transaction with any animal enterprises. Now, we know that this is theoretically aimed at those that are burning down the slaughterhouses and that sort of thing, but the language is so broad that it could literally make terrorists out of boycotters of a grocery store. And this is called domestic terrorism. So part of understanding that this loss of civil liberties that's been occurring, the habeas corpus, the Warner Act, the terrorist acts, all of this, and the increased surveillance of American citizens and that, is really understanding where the leadership class, the people in power today, are coming from and where they're going. The U.S. is now dominated by a neoconservative group of people with the shared goal of aggressively asserting U.S. military power worldwide. Now, this comes out of the University of Chicago's Committee of Social Thought. Leo Strauss and Paul Wolfowitz, Alan Bloom, Richard Perle were students. This is back in the 60s. They were working on neoconservatism. What does that mean, and where are we going with this? And Adbusters, kind of one of my favorite magazines, says that the neoconservatives believe that their belief in democracy is that, however flawed, is best defended by an ignorant public pumped up on nationalism and religion, and only a militantly nationalist state can deter human aggression. In other words, we have to be powerful and strong to deter the aggressors around the world. And such nationalism requires an external threat. And if one can't be found, then you manufacture it.
747.
The support for the Contras in the 80s is, for a majority of member states at the General Assembly, a clear case of state-sponsored terrorism by the U.S. or the role of the CIA in Nicaragua, mining the harbors in 84, for example, is for them clearly an act of state-sponsored terrorism, or the roles of the anti-Castro Cubans in Florida and their role in acts of terrorism is for them a clear case of the U.S. sponsoring terrorism, or at least harboring terrorists and not doing anything against them. So in that context, an extremely adversarial context, the U.S. during the 80s, during the Reagan years, it's not going to deny all those acts. What it's going to say is that if a state is involved in an act of terrorism in any way, shape, or form, if a state is involved directly or indirectly in an act of terrorism, then it's not an act of terrorism.
The international war against terrorism, a war in which those who monopolize terror are licensed to exempt themselves from its meaning. Lacking the resources of character to compete head-on, the global corporate gang everywhere relies on controlled images instead. And I think this is its peculiar quality. It's a kind of a public relations totalitarianism in the first instance. The image set loved most by the gang's crowds are performed around the clock. Symbolic male gangs and corporate logos attacking one another day in and day out in competitive spectacles, all constructed to glorify the riches of the winners. The never-ending sudden-death dramas hold the many in thrall, and so the actual violent struggles of life and death in the wider world are diverted from.
376.
According to Herman and Chomsky, the media maintains a corporate class bias through five filter systems: concentrated private ownership, a strict bottom-line profit orientation, an over-reliance on government and corporate sources for news, a tendency to avoid offending the powerful, and an almost religious worship of the market economy and strongly opposing any alternative beliefs. So this was coming out of the Cold War. This was a way of understanding how media was working at that time. And the owners and the managers, they share a class identity with the powerful. And they're motivated economically to please their advertisers and the viewers, for that matter. And their conception of what is newsworthy is influenced by their social background, their values, and what they call common sense. So journalists and editors are not immune from influence from owners and managers. And journalists want to see their stories in print. And editors come to know the limits, or what we call the parameters, of the common sense view of the world. So a whole lot of what passes for censorship or manufacturing consent is structural, in that journalists and editors come to understand what's acceptable news. And it's just part of the system. It's common sense within the system. So a lot of reasons these stories don't come out is kind of what we call self-censorship. They're just not seen as appropriate, or there's restricted and the filters are preventing that process. We also know that essentially the corporate media in the U.S. is in the entertainment business. Now, you know, we went back and checked when Paris Hilton went to jail. Fox News, in 3 weeks, had 56 headline stories on Paris Hilton. Now, I understand that Lindsay Lohan has just got arrested, so I think that's going to continue to be making the news as we go along. And so there's a, you know, whether it's Anna Nicole Smith dying or having her baby and all of that, there's an entertainment value that has an opportunity cost. So Neil Postman called the American society the best entertained, least informed society in the world. He said that 15 years ago, and that's becoming increasingly more evident today.
Hold the many in thrall, and so the actual violent struggles of life and death in the wider world are diverted from. They are displaced onto the sports or the war screen as a universal marketing site for corporations and banks. Behind the scenes, the real action goes on. Instruments of transnational trade and investment, competitive mergers and privatization and deregulation of the public sector are the deep booty system. Outside of the manufactured conflicts of the mass spectacle games the many have their hearts and minds fastened to, the world is restructured as a pay-on-time system where the payments issue more and more demand for all to pay. As this or that entertainment product wins or loses in the Colosseum, the gang's trade lawyers secretly construct hundreds of new laws behind everyone's backs in which only the rich can win, from outside the market, by the way. The new world order is backed by iron cages, starvation, rains of gas in clubs for resistors, and genocide for peoples from which the latest declared enemy comes. But few dare to name the game. And so its order is ritualized with ever more one-sided shows of mass destruction and violence discharged on the dispossessed to demonstrate the inevitability of its rule. Outside the bombing of poor peoples, whatever stands in the way of the global corporate gang's axings of expenditures on life is declared an obstacle to its freedom, in revealing slogan, a protectionist barrier. Any public law to regulate, protect, or retain control over any sector of domestic economies is prohibited. There is a prize for all this, and it is a prize without end. All free existence which corporate vehicles can reconstruct to extract profit from, without limit. In the end, the global corporate gang wages a war on life organization itself. I think it's really a metaphysical meaning here. The world in the revealing terms of the occupiers is a limitless market opportunity for, quote, maximum penetration and control. Yet in the era of the global knowledge economy, there is a vulnerability of this reign of fear and rapine which cannot be overcome. It can only work where its deep pattern evades exposure. Now I move into the final part, which I call the new totalitarianism. The deep pattern of the male corporate gang in its global form is, as David Rockefeller put it at the June 1991 Bilderberg meeting in Baden, Germany, a, quote, supernational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers, which is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries. As such a structure of world rule, it is accomplished by the same financial and media system deciders that put Tony Blair in office in Britain and George Bush into the White House against majority vote. Transnational corporations have marketed and financed these political leaders to ensure that captive states serve them rather than the peoples the governments are elected by. Guaranteeing through state plenipotentiaries and transnational trade edicts that governments can no longer govern them in their common interest without infringing the new trade and investment laws in which transnational corporations are alone granted rights, no rights to anything else. All along, the corporate media have, as Rockefeller again advises, and I quote from the same speech, cooperated, because it's to the media, they have cooperated with this plan for the world by, quote, a discretion of public secrecy for which he thanks them. Quote, it would have been impossible for us to develop a plan for the world if we had been subjected to the light of publicity during those years. With financial and media selectors ensuring compliant party government leaders, all the requirements for this plan for the world have been set in place for a totality of control of world societies by a centralized global system which is by law not accountable to any electorate or indeed anyone or any life requirement. I'm really ashamed of our government in its submissive role in all this. The meaning of the post-September 11 bombing of Afghanistan may be best understood in the light of this background. What is important to recognize beneath all the spasms of propaganda of America's new war and the forces of good versus evil, variations on a very old theme, is that every step and preparation and aftermath of this whole new war with no end confers cumulatively more strategic, legal and military control over the world's peoples and resources from an unaccountable U.S. financial and armed force center. That's its meaning.
Ken here. I was struck by an article in yesterday's newspaper. That was October 26, 2019. The U.S. is now sending its army into Syria to protect the oil fields. Zbigniew Brzezinski may have died in 2017, but he lives on at the White House and State Department and Pentagon. And the media bias we also heard about today lives on. The AP article reporting the Syrian re-invasion totally ignores these issues. What right do U.S. troops have to be anywhere in Syria in the first place? And what is the actual reason the U.S. government has deployed troops there and all over the Middle East? Could it possibly have anything to do with helping U.S.-based multinational oil corporations seize control of all the world's oil and natural gas? Just asking. I'm having a flashback to the U.S. military invasion and capture of Baghdad in 2003, when apparently the only building in the city they preserved, protected, and guarded was the oil ministry headquarters. Most of the rest of Baghdad that we hadn't already bombed to the ground was sacked. So compiler Robin Upton was quite right. Parts of the audio collage we heard today are almost 20 years old, but what was said is, as the cliché goes, as current as today's headlines. We'll hear the third part of The Terror Threat next week. See the rest of Robin's work, and Lynn Gary's before him, at unwelcomeguests.net. More of us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, once again thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Also advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.